5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I know you're gonna dig this.
Welcome to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
Think we could listen to the radio or something?
Radio? Who needs a radio?
Featuring the biggest names and newsmakers from the world of sports media.
Don't act like you're not impressed.
Now, here's your host, the president of Barrett Sports Media, Jason Barrett.
Greetings once again from the friendly confines of Barrett Sports Media headquarters, where podcasting brilliance is now in full effect. Well, not exactly, but it is our 9th episode of the Barrett Sports Media podcast, and you've been treated to the vocal stylings of yours truly, Jason Barrett. My guest this week is Fox Sports Radio's newest acquisition, former ESPN and CBS Sports personality Doug Gottlieb. If you love sports, chances are you've heard or seen Doug share his thoughts during the past 15 years. He's a prominent college basketball analyst and national sports radio host, and having worked with him along the way and kept in contact over the years, I think you're going to enjoy the different areas we get into during this week's conversation. One thing I want to point out that some of you may not be aware of is that I do make appearances on radio stations across the country when I'm asked to and when it fits my schedule. I've appeared on NBC Sports Radio, SB Nation Sports Radio, The Fan in DC, The Fan in Florida, KGR in Seattle, just to name a few, as well as a number of podcasts. By no means am I telling you to invite me on your show, but if a sports media issue pops up and you feel it makes sense to bring someone on to offer some strong insight and opinion on the story, I'm more than happy to be an option to you. You can get in touch on Twitter at SportsRadioPD, or you can find me through my website, sportsradiopd.com. That brings to a close the promotional part of the podcast, which means we're now ready to dive into this week's starting point.
Quiet on the set. Can we please have quiet on the set?
Action! In case you didn't notice, Fox Sports Radio has undergone a lineup makeover during the past few years. And if image is everything, as Andre Agassi once claimed, then Fox has a great shot at winning a few beauty pageants in the near future. Turn back the clock for a minute to early 2013, just a presidential term ago. The network's weekday lineup consisted of Artrell Hawkins and Andy Furman in mornings, Dan Patrick from 9 to noon, Jay Moore from noon to 3, Pat O'Brien and Steve Hartman in afternoons, and evenings and overnights with Petros and Money, JT the Brick, and Rob Dibble and Amy Van Dyken. Although some of those programs were solid and featured personalities who've had success in local markets, the national perception was that they were a step behind ESPN Radio. And after losing Jim Rome to CBS in late 2012, the feeling inside many industry circles was that Fox had a lot of work to do to stay in the number two position, let alone challenge for the top spot. Flash forward now, though, to 2017, and in 2 weeks, the weekday lineup on Fox Sports Radio will consist of Clay Travis in Morning Drive, Dan Patrick 9 to noon, Colin Cowherd noon to 3, Doug Gottlieb 3 to 6, and nights and overnights handled by Steve Gorman, JT the Brick, Jason Smith, and Ben Maller. That's an impressive overhaul for Fox. It's one that's been viewed very favorably by programmers and market managers who I've talked to about the network space. Don Martin, Scott Shapiro, Julie Talbot, and Jamie Horowitz deserve a ton of credit for making changes to strengthen the perception of the Fox Sports Radio brand, and I'm sure those talent acquisitions haven't been cheap. But as the old saying goes, you get what you paid for. Radio executives in local markets have traditionally flocked to ESPN Radio because the recognition of those four letters is tremendous, and the lineup that accompanied it was seen as being the highest form of national sports talk quality. When you combine the weekday lineup with the network's play-by-play assets and the guest access for affiliated stations to ESPN's popular personalities and reporters, it's been a winning combination for the past few decades. It's been so popular that the ESPN Radio Network reached the point where it could start charging an annual rights fee to stations to carry their programming, and they still do to this day. But as we sit here in 2017, ESPN Radio is going through a transformation itself. New faces and voices have been inserted into the weekday lineup over the past few years, and it takes time for new shows to earn acceptance. Those I've talked to aren't convinced the network is better than it was 5 years ago. And if Mike and Mike are broken up, as many expect they will be, that presents another problem for local stations. For the first time in a long time, people will be inside of conference rooms asking the question, how valuable is ESPN Radio to our business? Is it worth paying for? Should we be looking at other alternatives? Now, ESPN Radio's play-by-play still packs a punch, and it helps local brands generate ratings and revenue. The guests are still top-notch, and the recent decision by the network to add Justin Craig to the programming team tells me that they know that some work has to be done to improve the overall quality. But for some local stations, which rely on network programming to offset costs and keep ratings high, they'll need convincing to stay the course. They weren't asked for an opinion on lineup changes, yet those very decisions have had a direct impact on their overall business. ESPN may, in some cases, choose to waive their rights fee to save an affiliation, but that won't satisfy everyone. Operators have shown they don't mind spending a few thousand dollars for programming, but they do expect high quality in return. If ESPN Radio wants to keep stations partnering with them and investing in their future, it starts with reclaiming a dominant position with its lineup. Fox has shown they're serious about the network space. They've taken ESPN Radio's core from a few years ago and made it their own. That's smart business. Although many still choose the four-letter brand over the three-letter option, those opinions are changing rapidly. You have to be known for more than just your name. Right now, that's what ESPN has been relying on. Fox, on the other hand, is building its story around some incredible talent. Let me know what you think of the national sports radio picture. You can reach me on Twitter at SportsRadioPD or by email jbarrett@sportsradiopd.com. It's now time to shift our attention towards this week's conversation, and it takes place with the newest employee of Fox Sports 1 and Fox Sports Radio. That would be Doug Gottlieb. Now, Doug and I have personal history together. We've shared studios before, although that was a decade ago and we were a lot younger and much more hard-headed. We had some fascinating battles, let me tell you. As a producer for Doug, his ADD could drive you nuts. On the other hand, my insistence on being perfect probably made him crazy. I will say this, although he contributed to some of my hair loss in Bristol, he's a guy with a ton of talent and personality, and those traits have clearly made him an attractive commodity to ESPN, CBS Sports, and now Fox. Doug is making his debut across the nation on Fox Sports Radio starting Monday, April 24th. He'll be heard weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern Time. He'll also be appearing on FS1's programs as a basketball analyst, so keep an eye out for him on The Herd, Undisputed, Speak for Yourself, and a couple of other programs the network will feature in the future. He's a guy with a lot going on, never short of opinion. Here's my chat this week with Doug Gottlieb.
And now, our feature presentation.
Congrats, first of all. You've landed with Fox Sports Radio, FS1. That now means, though, Doug, that you've worked for three different national networks over the past decade, so I'm not going to see you holding an NBC microphone in 3 or 4 years, am I?
I don't think so. It's weird. It's like the good part is I'm well-traveled, and I've been inside two very different corporate cultures, and I think Fox is an even different corporate culture. When I left ESPN, it was really, really hard. I was very conflicted. I had buyer's remorse. And it wasn't necessarily in regards to CBS. It was just you and I were there together.
Yep.
And I literally grew up there as an adult. You know, like I stopped playing when I was 26, and when I was 27, I'm there on campus. And I kind of look back, and it wasn't the golden era of Keith and Dan on SportsCenter, but in regards to the entire place, it probably was. Because I thought that's when ESPN News was really, really good. SportsCenter was solid. Shapiro was running the place, and I felt like it was young. It was dynamic. You know, and I remember, and I thought the radio lineup, frankly, once they added Cowherd, I mean, that was, and I know you just had Bruce Gilbert on, who, you know, we both have an immense amount of respect for. And I'm frankly just got done sort of kind of quasi working for him, as there's a partnership between Westwood One and CBS. And ironically, obviously, he used to run Fox Sports Radio. So we keep missing each other by 6 months or so. You know, with Bruce running radio, I felt like radio was more dynamic than at any other point in their history. So when I left ESPN, we'd had three kids there. I had friends in the town of Canton where we lived. I just felt very comfortable. I'd worked with every different entity of that company from, you know, I started with radio, but also began on TV with news. And then from news became SportsCenter, became games, became studio, became the magazine, became digital. You name it, I touched all those places. And then living there, I knew everybody. And so I was going into the kind of vast unknown. And it's like one of those things, like you chase the job and the big chair, but you don't even think about the culture at the time, the change in your life, the uprooting of your family. We just were like, California, home in the afternoon, Final Four, where do we sign? And then you sign, you're like, holy shit, what did I just do, right?
Yeah.
First, you go through like 4 months where you're not working. You having been there, you understand it. You just become trained, ingrained at ESPN, to which if you're not working, somebody doesn't like you. I went through like 4 months of not working and I was just felt awful. I felt off. I felt weird. I didn't know the CBS people. I was moving to LA where there was no CBS. I'd go down, drive down once a week and do auditions for the TV show with the people in New York. And they were terribly nice. They just didn't understand, like, emotionally. Like, I'm like, why am I not working? I have the exact opposite feeling now. Colin had kind of been recruiting me without recruiting me for, you know, since he got there. You know, Jamie Horowitz had always, you know, made me feel like I was kind of part of his crew back when I was the consummate fill-in on all his shows, especially Sports Nation. Like, they retired my sport coat on Sports Nation up in the rafters. And then we played basketball together in the winter and in the summer on the outdoor courts. And so without recruiting me, he'd always like talk to me about moving to LA because for his wife, you know, use my wife as a resource. And I always felt like, well, that would just make sense. And then you go through like the radio guys and Scott Shapiro, who I work with at ESPN, and the TV guys from Steve Lavin to Casey Jacobson to Mike Hill to, you know, whomever, like these are all people that I've worked with before. From the moment that that became a reality, like, hey, they want to offer you a deal. Here's the deal. Here's the money. Here's the timing. What do you think? It just became, I had a completely different feeling because it felt so comfortable. Look, I think the radio lineup is incredibly dynamic. I think what they're building TV, they're doing smartly piece by piece instead of doing the entire, you know, 24/7. And I feel super comfortable and there's been zero buyer's remorse.
So you're not going to tell me then that it was the California sun and access to local beaches that swung the vote in favor of Fox, right? Relationships played a part.
To me, the relationships are everything. You know, you got to go a place where you fit.
Well, when you see Cowherd, bust his chops for me because I love Colin, but I didn't agree with his commentary on ESPN being at a disadvantage due to being based in Bristol, Connecticut. We spent time at ESPN. Hell, in Colin's case, he spent a decade there. We didn't go there because we loved the surrounding neighborhoods. We went there because of the job, right?
So I grew up in Orange County in Southern California. We're moving back, and I'm going to do the drive to LA or to wherever the radio is in Sherman Oaks because, you know, it's important to me for my kids to feel comfortable. We're trying to put them in the same school, live close to my mom, close to my friends. For my wife, it is actually very important. Like, she struggles. She's always struggled with the winters. She's from Oklahoma, but she struggles with the winters in Connecticut. She thinks it changes her emotions, which it probably does. And I think there's some truth to what Colin's saying. I can tell you in all honesty, like, I liked living in Canton, Connecticut, where I lived when I was at ESPN. Maybe I built it up as a utopia that wasn't really, but, you know, like Sage Steele was my neighbor, John Anderson, who his wife is an OSU alum, was my neighbor. We had Mormon neighbors who we were super close with, and the public schools are good. The cost of living there is reasonable in comparison to California. Like, and Colin, God bless him, when he got married the second time, like, his house was gorgeous, but he wasn't necessarily, it was like six houses in a subdivision instead of like getting into a neighborhood like we did. So, you know, everybody's experience is different. I do know that if you're single, West Hartford might not be the thing for you. If you're married, like, look, you can buy a beautiful and a nice house in a nice neighborhood and send your kids to public school and be fine.
I know you've got family in the Bay Area. I spent 4 years there. It's the best place I've ever lived. And of course, if I have my druthers, I'd be in the Bay Area instead of upstate New York. But a lot of this also comes down to who you're working for, good relationships. It comes down to what they're paying you. And then, of course, yes, you want to feel good in your surroundings. And in your case, you have family and roots in Southern California. If your roots, though, were in Minneapolis and Southern California was offering you $50,000 less than what you were making at your previous job, you're not moving there.
But here's a little bit about what he's saying. There's a different sensibility when you have West Coast guys. You're just wired differently. You know, like, look, at ESPN, there's the Syracuse Mafia. They're East Coast sports fans. They're fervent. You know, there's Yankees and Red Sox and Syracuse and Pats and Giants and Jets and whatever. And, like, if you're not in L.A., you have a completely different sensibility. And I do think that's a little bit about, like, what Colin's getting at. And here's where I bust his balls. Like, he thinks he's, like, real L.A. now. Like, look, dude, you live in Manhattan Beach, all right? That's not – you don't live in El Monte, all right? You don't live in Pico Rivera. I grew up in the city of Orange. I went to a bilingual elementary school. You know, Southern California is a completely different experience based upon how much money you make. But I will say, you never check the weather. Fritz Coleman's been doing it for years. I have no idea if he's good, if he's accurate, because I don't know. You know why? Because it's 75 and sunny. Occasionally get the Santa Ana, occasionally get a little wind, right? You know, like, I don't care. And it just creates a different vibe around the place. And even East Coast guys who go there, you're like, dude, what happened to you? Like, you're thinner, you're smiling more, your clothes are different. It's just, it is very, very different.
Everybody on the East Coast is wired in this aggressive manner. It's because you deal with a ton of bullshit with traffic. You got bosses yelling at you. You know, you're brought up on New York teams that if you don't win a World Series, it's a lost season. And then you go to California, it's a lot more relaxed. People enjoy themselves. And yeah, there is something to be said about every day when you wake up and there's sunshine outside versus looking at a gray sky and snow or rain. So I totally understand that. It's just, it's easier to say that when the job is very good and the people you're working right with are very familiar to you.
And that's the interesting thing about, you know, why I think I struggled early on in my relationships at CBS when I moved out to California was, you know, I had, and the crew we worked with when I did Lead Off was a TV show, you know, we were just wired completely differently than our bosses in New York, you know. And remember, it's not just New York, like CBS is Midtown New York, BlackRock, coat, tie to work, you know. Midtown New York is different than any other part of New York City. Mm-hmm. Like everybody in Midtown wears a suit and a tie to work. And dude, I wear flip-flops every day. I would wear, you know, board shorts, flip-flops and a t-shirt, and then throw on jeans and sneakers and a sport coat. And I'm sure that was different for them. And so I know what your point is. Your point is Colin's full of shit when he's saying, hey, the reason people are leaving ESPN is because of California. Right. I think people have different reasons for leaving different things.
Talk to me about this, because you're going there now, and obviously you're going to have some bias in the fact that this is going to be your employer now, but you've also watched them develop over the last 2 years. When you look at Fox Sports 1 and the way it's progressed, and you've been on the other side at ESPN, what would you say the company is doing or the channel is doing from a positive standpoint, and where do you think there's some holes that have to be filled?
From a positive standpoint, I think they're doing a great job promoting their big personalities. And even within that, here's where Colin's a champ. He has evolved as a broadcaster. Like one of the things, and I think you had Bruce Gilbert on, Bruce was big on this in radio, which was like, you can't do the same show this year that you did 5 years ago, mm-hmm. right? You got to evolve. One of the things Colin's evolved to is passing the mic. Look what he's done for Nick Wright. I mean, like, I think Nick is a very talented guy, but he was talented before. The difference is Colin is confident enough and has the backing enough to, like, when he has him on, like, Nick, you got a rant today? Go, you know, wind up and go. Instead of some people bringing you on and they like having you on as a guest, but they want to end up being the smartest guy in the room at the end of the discussion. And Colin's, he's totally fine. So I think twofold, company-wise, they're doing a great job of building up the brands of their individual personalities. And then I think those personalities, in turn, have built up some of the lesser-known personalities for future growth.
Yep.
And I think that's really the leadership there. I don't think there's a leadership void at ESPN. I just think there's too much leadership. And everybody kind of has their own vision. Whereas I do feel like at Fox, and again, this is from a guy who has not yet truly worked there, I do think it, because it's such a small group, I think there's a clear vision, and the vision is build up personalities, and in turn, those personalities will let other personalities flourish. There's plenty of time for all of us to talk, for all of us to get attention. Let's build them kind of organically over time. I think they've done an outstanding job of that. What do they need to do more of or better? I'm sure they're torn as to, do we do morning, which I think is coming? Do we do night, which I'm sure is coming? It's one of the things to which people who don't know how to read the ratings might not understand. Like, you have to build throughout the day. You can't have one show and then something doesn't make sense and then another show, and that doesn't build the number. And mm-hmm. so whatever you think of Skip's numbers or Collins' numbers. Remember, there's essentially no lead in to Skip's numbers. So you're going from zero to 100,000. That's hard to do.
Well, it's also midday too. Let's face it. Most guys 25 to 54 are at work. And so you are going to play to a smaller crowd. You know, on that note, Richard Deitch has made a habit out of having some fun with the numbers. And I laugh now. At first, I was like, man, he's kind of going after this guy a lot. And it's obvious because he doesn't like the show. But, you know, when you're bringing up Lassie and SpongeBob, I'm like, well, they're kind of going after a different demographic, to be honest. But, you know, when any narrative is pumped over and over and over again, people start to read it. They start to assume, especially in the beginning with the new show, that it's not doing well. You may at one point be under that scrutiny yourself soon, you know, because he's clearly not a fan. When you see that, though, what goes through your mind?
I think it's embarrassing what you know, Richard tweeting that out. Hey, dude, you got a podcast. Let's see your numbers. Compare them to Colin's podcast numbers. And, oh, yeah, by the way, you want to compare it to SpongeBob? That's cool. Compare it to First Take. Compare the numbers to all the other sports shows at the exact same time. Like you said, the target demo, year to year. And, hey, it's hard, man. I had a TV show. It was on a network that didn't rate, so I have no idea if it did well, if it didn't do well. I thought it was pretty good. But, you know, we didn't have a lead-in unless it was a game, and it wasn't easy. If his job is to be the sports media reporter, well, then he should break news. He should be ahead of stories. He should tell people what's going on kind of behind the scenes, which he does some of, but not a ton of. Like, he didn't break the Romo story. He didn't break Cowherd's story. Like, now, is he an analyst of television shows? Is that his role? That's his role. Like, one, he ain't never been on TV before, so he's kind of commenting on stuff he doesn't know about. Two, go through shows, watch an entire show, watch an entire week of show, and go through things and give the analysis, right? That's what I do for basketball. Is I go through a game, I give analysis. If that's your job, do it. But just taking pot shots because you don't like the debate format or you don't like Skip Bayless, that shows obviously a great insecurity. But also, like, I don't know how, if you're Sports Illustrated, who, by the way, works in concert with Fox Sports, how you think that's good. You become kind of the laughingstock of broadcasting. People at CBS, they take what Richard Deitch says to be kind of the law. He wrote after my first Final Four that there wasn't great chemistry on the set, and I'm sure that affected how they looked at the chemistry on the set. And maybe he was just echoing what they said. That's fine. But there are people in New York that take him seriously. I think the rest of us in broadcasting are like, dude, what's your deal, dude? Because you're not giving an accurate depiction of ratings. Everybody in sports media knows this. I've actually was at a bar last year in New Hampshire. My kids went to summer camp, and my wife and I and two of my other kids, we stopped and had a snack at a bar, and there were people watching Gunsmoke. So I think those numbers are in fact real. Like, and Gunsmoke is an awesome show, but like, that's not the target demo, dude.
Right.
Compare it to whatever's on NBCSN, compare it to whatever's on ESPN, ESPN2. Like, if you don't think that Fox Sports is changing the landscape of sports media, then why did ESPN move all their personality programming to ESPN1? If it wasn't making waves, if it wasn't affecting their business, they would not have changed their business model. They did. So what he's tweeting is 100% inaccurate. And by the way, it's his job to be accurate.
You just mentioned a little while ago how CBS takes their pulse sometimes from Richard Deitch's pieces. And I want to talk to you about the CBS experience, because you had a couple years there now. As you look back on your tenure there, how would you classify it?
Missed opportunity on both ends.
How so?
My vision when I joined them to do college basketball was to be a newer, younger, fresher version of Billy Packer. And I thought they shared that vision. And because of, I'm sure, some of my own missteps in their mind and the fact that I never felt like they truly supported me, there were just things that they couldn't get past to elevate me to a level to which I was impervious to a pot shot from a Richard Deitch or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Like, look, and I'm not perfect. I made some mistakes. Look, when I signed the deal, I was most cautious about radio just because I met with Mark Chernoff and Eric Spitz and Chris Olivero. You know, that's a three-headed monster that runs that place. You know, look, I came from the Bruce Gilbert style of radio, right? I cut my teeth listening to Dan, to Colin. When I was a kid, obviously listening to Rome. I remember I had a meeting with them and this is months before the deal was done. It was like April, right? Mm-hmm. And they said, what are you going to talk about in this afternoon show? It was like April. And I was like, well, you know, you lead with NBA and then NFL draft. And then you kind of go from there. And I kind of gave them like five topics. I'm like, not baseball? And I go, not baseball. And this is in 2012. And they're like, why wouldn't you talk about baseball? And I was like, because nobody cares about baseball. They're like, well, we care about baseball. I was like, because you're in New York. And I was like, New York and Boston care about baseball. Nobody else does. And guess what? I'm not on in New York and Boston, except if I'm on satellite radio. So if I was on in New York and Boston and local radio, then I would talk about the Yankees, talk about the Red Sox, but it's April. Nobody cares. NFL draft, NFL, big names in the NBA, like, you know, play the hits. That's our job. And like, well, what about taking phone calls? Like, if it makes sense, right? You know, have a good take, maybe read a text, maybe take a phone call, maybe read a tweet, play some sound, tease the break, bring on a guest and argue with them or discuss something with them. Like, that's kind of the deal, right? There was a great divide. Like, I was like, dude, I don't know if I can do that. But to their credit, they gave me complete carte blanche freedom to do whatever I wanted on radio. Like, look, Eric Spitz would call me and it's like, hey, I think you should do this a little bit more. You know, he would ask me, you know, why don't you have a guest at the top of the hour? And I don't think in national radio you bring a guest on the top of the hour. Here's why. Unless you have to. You know, there were still things in which we didn't agree upon, but they never once said, like, you should do this, you should do that. And by the end of it, 5 years later, I feel like they respected the amount of work I did, the style I did. And in many ways, they asked us to be the model show for other shows. Once we moved back to New York a couple years ago, they're like, hey, you guys should pick their brain, which was cool. But I still think it's a missed opportunity because 3 to 6 is a hard time slot nationally to get on some of the big East Coast markets. And we never got on satellite. And I just felt like it hadn't hit yet. You know, they were never willing at CBS to sacrifice any of their local programming, with the exception of the sports minutes, for the national network, as opposed to ESPN, who maybe they end up hurting their local product. It's probably true by pushing Mike and Mike and pushing Colin at the time and now pushing Levitard, whatever. But at least that was, hey, we got this national network. We're going to make you carry it. They didn't do that. And so I'd say it's a missed opportunity there. Like, I felt like, look, I'm selfish. I mean, I know Jim Rome makes more money than I have and has done a great job. Like, I felt like we had the best show on the network, and I just didn't feel like the TV network got behind the radio network. There was never any correlation. It was just we all wore the I, but there's not a ton. It's not like ESPN where there's integration where, hey, somebody really good's on radio. Let's put them on TV. Let's pump it out on .com. Let's work together. They're still kind of figuring that out, and so I think it's a little bit of a missed opportunity.
You mentioned ESPN. Obviously, that's a completely different world from the one you just went through with CBS. You still have a lot of friends, great memories from your time there. When you see the narrative that's being written about the network now and the way things have changed since you left, I left, many others left, how does it sit with you?
It's interesting because I still think there's a lot of smart, awesome people there. There's a lot of talented people on there. I think they have a lot of masters they're trying to please. I remember when I got there, I think the mantra was, you know, we're serving the fans. And I thought it was really, really smart, which plays along in concert with the idea of playing the hits. The big mistake that so many make in radio, and I know, remember you used to tell me this, and everybody continues to reiterate it, which is like, don't talk about what you want to talk about. Talk about what everybody else wants to talk about, right? And radio guys, we make that mistake sometimes, and we think everybody sees the world as we do. You got to play to the widest set of the audience. I think they've lost a little bit of track of that, in that they've tried to please small fringe sections instead of, hey man, it's a sports network. Talk about sports at all angles of it. Have some personality doing it. Instead of trying to fill out a roster so that it looks like United Nations, like, just get really good people and talk about sports. And I personally think, like, Michael Smith was awesome to work with. I think he's tremendous. I'm really glad he's gotten the promotion that they've gotten. And I think he and Jamel have incredible chemistry, and that's really hard to create. But they're not good because they're black. They're good because they're good.
Right.
They just happen to be black. So I think sometimes they overthink things in terms of, we got to have this on a show. We got to have that on a show. Just have a good show. You're ESPN. Like, don't think about it. Just go. But I also think some of it's just unfair. You know, we were told not to talk politics, not to talk religion. And right before I left, the Tebow thing happened. And it made it impossible to not talk about religion. I was on air when President Obama got elected the first time. Like, I got really emotional, and not because I'm some super, super big Democrat. Like, I'm more of a centrist than anything. It was more the emotion of the next generation had taken over the country, that we had decided to change, to evolve. And like, I just thought that was an incredible, incredible moment. And I would talk about it some, but there was never any negative backlash. The problem is that politics has gotten to be so visceral on both sides. I think Clay Travis says that the left has gone right. Right, where it used to be the party of inclusion, but if you don't agree with their side, right, well, then they're going to exclude you. Well, that doesn't make any sense. It's gotten really hard to not talk about it. It's also, I think, one of the pitfalls of Twitter, which is if you operate on the world of Twitter, and I was like a year late in getting into it because I was like, why would I give away my content on the social media device? That was my initial thought. And then if you live in that world is very, very liberal. And that world thinks it's hugely involved in politics, right? And by the way, it is, because our president is on Twitter. I do think that some of the pot shots to ESPN has always been slightly like, I'll never watch ESPN again. Like, bullshit. If the good game is on, you'll watch the good game, right?
Yep.
Now, do I think their radio is great? I don't. There's so many different chefs in that kitchen, and not all the chefs in the kitchen are radio people. I think if I put you in charge of ESPN radio, I think you'd do a pretty good job. You know, they brought Bruce back in, like a radio dude. You'd figure out a way to make it work. But the problem is they have so many different people who have an opinion. I don't think they're great. I don't think it's where it was. We used to have those town hall meetings for all the talent. And the two times I paid attention were, one, when Shapiro was in front of the room. I mean, Mark Shapiro was incredibly dynamic. Like, nobody moved. Nobody looked at their cell phone. I have no idea if he knew what he's doing or didn't know what he's doing. I can only tell you, for that hour that he was up speaking, he was awesome, right? The other guy was a guy named Barry Blinn, who did all the research for ESPN. And his thing was, the downfall of ESPN is not going to be a full frontal attack. It's going to be a thousand little cuts. It's going to be losing a portion here to NBCSN, losing a portion here, losing a portion here, losing a portion here. And I think that's really what's happened. I think the NFL Network, you know, is doing a better job than they previously did. Plus, they now have NFL games. NBCSN, even though their games are niche, that takes away hockey fans. I think MLB Network does an amazing job. Like, MLB Network is really, really good. And then the more frontal attack is FS1, who's going after the personality-based programming. And then, oh yeah, by the way, FS1 is getting the Big Ten next year to go with the Pac-12. It's got Big 12 football. And then, you know, FS1 next year or the following year outrates ESPN2, and now all of a sudden Camelot is gone. I kind of think that's more what's taking place, more so than anything else.
You mentioned something earlier while we were chatting about the way Colin has grown as a broadcaster. How has Doug Gottlieb grown as a broadcaster over the last 10 years?
I've really refined my game broadcast at CBS over the last 5 years because of a couple things. One, working, there's a guy named Steve Karasek who is one of the executive producers for college basketball. He does also NFL. Like, he's really good. When I was at ESPN, and I think I still carry some of this, this actually kind of hurt me at CBS a little bit. What happens is when you host a race sports radio show, people think like, oh, sports radio guy, hot tick guy, right? Like, they think like, well, first of all, that's not how I do my radio show. Second of all, sports radio is awesome because you have to be able, you know, with the exception of people who write out their show, you have to be able to think on your feet, be nimble, plant, pivot, something happens, react, and also have the knowledge to where when you react, you don't say something that is completely moronic. But the negative to being a radio host is that if you go right from radio to studio, in which I did at ESPN, I did some at CBS Sports Network, you have a tendency to talk in too long of bites, right? Mm-hmm. So you have to learn the economy of words. And I had to learn the economy of words on studio, which I struggle with at CBS just because, I mean, there's no time to talk, zero, like 6 minute half times. You know, Seth Davis is good at it, but even he will filibuster you. And, you know, other people we work with, they have no sense of time. And like, you get it back to 15 seconds. It's hard to sound really smart in 15 seconds. But in game broadcast, they put me early on cable with a couple other guys, notably like Steve Lapis, who at the time was fairly inexperienced calling games, but it allowed me in working with Lap to pick and choose when I would get in and when I would get out and how I could get in on a telestration and get out and still allow him a chance to be a color analyst as well. It really taught me, organically taught me, economy of words. Steve Karasik helped me clean up some stuff in my game broadcast. And then Steve Scheer, who's now at Fox, who's a long time at CBS, he told me one time, he's like, look, dude, you work at CBS now. In addition to people not being used to your level of analysis, they also remember, like, this is a Saturday afternoon, 50-year-old guy, kids in the background, flip on a game. You can't talk over their head. Like on ESPN or maybe on CBS Sports Network, like you can be more intricate in your details of breaking things down. You got to give them baby bites. You got just a little nibble. And so they might learn something. And then actually there's a guy named Ross Molloy who works with talent. And one time I'm doing a game, it's like a San Diego State game, and something happened with the tape. I was trying to show something called an elevator screen. And the idea of an elevator screen is the shooter runs between two guys, and then they lock shoulder to shoulder, and it becomes like an elevator door. And so I say, you know, here's an elevator screen, and I get screwed. The replay doesn't show. So he's like, look, I did not play basketball growing up. I have no idea what the hell an elevator screen is. You sound like some crazy dude yelling, elevator screen! Right? And so the lesson I learned was, hey, don't do the John Gruden and give all this lingo unless, and Gruden does a really good job of this, unless you show me what you're talking about. Just give me that little nibble, that little baby bite that Steve Scheer talked about, of morsel of information that I can digest, teach me something, and hell, I can walk away from a game going like, that guy taught me something I never knew before. And I think I've become really, really good at that. It's one of the reasons that I actually work with zero notes, because once you start diving your notes, nobody can pick all that crap up. If you don't know it cold, then you don't know it, and you shouldn't be spitting it to somebody else.
So when you and I worked together on the radio side a while back, keep in mind, we were working on a six-hour show, which is death for anyone working in this business. That's a long time. And a lot of it was... Yeah, a lot of it was think on your feet, and you know. But we also had 15, 16 interviews a night. And when I worked with you, I thought, man, this guy's got a ton of talent, ton of personality, could be outstanding. The two things that used to drive me crazy with you is focus and trust. You were early in your time at Bristol. You didn't trust the producer at that point, and you were being pulled in so many different directions between TV needs you for a hit. We're trying to do 15 interviews a night, and you got to record things. And at that time, to be honest, I didn't think about it from the talent standpoint of like, look, this guy's being pulled in four different directions. Yeah, radio may be my only thing, but what would I do in his spot? So I've learned over the time that, you know, hey, sometimes you have to adjust to those things. But how is your focus and trust improved when it comes to the radio side of things?
It's better. It's still not great. Look, I've worked with Adam Kluge, my producer.
Yep.
And as of now, he will not be joining me at Fox, which is, it hurts my heart a little bit. But we fight like brothers, but I trust him. And when he's like, this is the topic we need to be hitting on, I do, in fact, trust him. And when he throws a question to ask in an interview in my ear, I will generally go with it. I'll word it in my own way. And when he screws me and asks the question, or when he's talking and I'm trying to listen to the, because everything I believe in is, it's like the Sawatsky method we learned at ESPN, which is, you know, you have to listen to their answers and ask a follow-up question, who, what, when, why, and how, based upon, you know, kind of the path you're taking them down. And so sometimes when a producer's talking and you're trying to listen, it becomes disconcerting. He's gotten better at it, and I've gotten better at finding when I can listen to him, when I can give him a little sign to hush up for a second because I'm really trying to listen. Look, I'm a multitasker because I'm probably borderline ADD, right? Like, it drove CBS crazy that I would be on Twitter during a basketball game. Like, what are you doing during a break? Concentrating, like. And what's funny is then when you do the tournament, you know, Turner gets like, hey, you can't tweet enough. You can't Instagram enough. We want you on social media. Like, CBS is like, no.
Back when I worked with you, Twitter didn't exist. I can only imagine how much of a challenge that would have been.
Right?
6 hours with you on Twitter trying to talk about, you know, four different sports, 16 guests a night, still trying to find a groove together as producer and host. I mean, it's not easy.
No, it was not easy, but three sports, because Bruce Gilbert called me in after my first year and said, hey, I got good news and bad news. And I was like, what's the bad news? Like, you're not very good at talking about baseball. It's like, okay, what's the good news? He's like, you never talk about hockey ever again. Every research we do tells us, don't talk about hockey. People change the channel. I was like, done. Thank you. But the two things that you picked up on are great. First, pulled in different directions. I know I have some really good friends at ESPN. I'm sure there are some people that felt like I wasn't as engaged in our conversations. And some of it was just a product of, I spread myself way too thin. how I played in basketball, trying to make everybody better, pleasing everybody, is how I am as a broadcast, as a human being. Like, I'm constantly trying to help other people. And like, oh, ESPN News needs you. All right, fine, I'll run down the hall. And then I'll run back. And what happens is you get done doing radio. For example, at the end, I was doing 4 to 7 radio. Well, then you got halftime of a 7 o'clock basketball game. You click off. There's no time for a meeting. There's no time for anything. You're just like, I got to put my suit and tie on. I got to get makeup. You walk in, it's 7:30, 7:45. You have your first hit. What are we talking about? You know, like, I got to talk about a game that I've watched in very small doses of. And so I'm sure that, you know, like John Saunders like called me aside one time. Like, hey, look, you got to come in and you got to talk to all the camera people. And I was like, John, I just got done doing radio. I ran over here and the guy had no idea. Like, you're not making any pre-show meetings. So I think sometimes my wife calls it Hurricane Doug. I kind of just come in and I'm like, all right, just tell me how long I have to talk and tell me what we're talking about. And let's roll, you know?
Right.
And people are like, well, you didn't make the meeting. And you didn't, like, I couldn't make the meeting. I was working. And then when I came to CBS, I think the same thing was an issue because they didn't have anybody who was really multi-platform. You know, I would do my radio show at Anaheim Stadium. Mm-hmm. I'd go home. I'd spend like an hour and a half, 2 hours with my kids, whatever. And then I'd come back in. The TV guys, they were like, when I first started doing it, they were like, hey, how come you weren't here at 4 o'clock? I was like, well, dude, I got into my radio show, which is a 3-hour show, and I spent 2 hours of prepping. And secondly, when I signed to do this deal, it was supposed to be a live show at 9 o'clock, get there at 7. Like, I'm here at 6. Like, you know, like, I just needed a chance to get my head above water. And then on Fridays, we'd get done taping the show at like 8:45. I'd drive to John Wayne. I'd catch a 9:26 flight from John Wayne to New York nonstop. I'd go to the hotel, I'd take a nap, I wake up, I go to the meeting, we do the halftime, I get a car service, I get to the airport, I fly home. Like, there's a lot of shit going on there.
Yeah.
And everybody else in their own world is like, well, shit, I didn't even get to say hi to him. You know, I'm like, well, damn, dude, like, I got a radio show, a TV show in college basketball, and I'm a dad of three, and I actually try and be a parent. So, you know, and I've never pouted about it. I've always found it hard to explain to people that when you're a multi-platform guy and you're trying to rule the world in television, that sometimes you don't spend enough time focusing on each individual group and your relationship can suffer because of it. The trust thing is interesting because, you know, one of the things that I find interesting is sometimes as talent, we take our producers as for granted.
Mm-hmm.
And like, Adam is amazing. He is great. You know him, I know him. He's freaking great. The problem with really good producers is that at some point producers make too much money to be producers anymore. And then, so they move into other jobs and sometimes not even good at those jobs, but you know, there's a limit to how much money you can make as a producer. And it's hard to build up that trust. You know, I won't name names. I had you in my ear, very good. I had Justin Craig in my ear. I had Jeremiah Crow in my ear, who went from being a board op to being a producer and became a really good one. He's the best I've ever worked with at sound. Like, really, really good at sound. And then we had somebody who's now a producer there who was awful at sound. And, I mean, she's just killing me. But she's grown and she's evolved. Louise Cornetto was a producer for Todd Wright All Night, and I filled in for him. That was my first foray. Like, she was awesome. And I've worked with, you know, Vince Cates was the best at, like, you're lost in a thought, and he knows exactly what you're trying to say, and you can't get it out. And Adam's become really good at finishing your sentences. And, like, I don't need you to come up with a thought for me, although sometimes I do. I need you to finish my sentence when I get stuck. And that comes from trust, and that comes from listening, and that comes from understanding what angle somebody's taking. Because I have had a producer or two that I literally had to not listen in my ear because where they thought I was going was the opposite of where I was going.
Well, you mentioned CBS a few minutes ago. I want to touch on something they've recently decided. They're bringing in Tony Romo. They've moved Phil Simms out of the top spot. You're a guy who went from playing collegiately and then overseas to making the transition into sports media. You know what it's like to have the red light on and, you know, have millions of people watching you and dissecting everything you say. What is he going through, and what would be your advice to him on how to handle this? Because clearly, he's going to be under scrutiny from day one.
Well, first, it sucks for Phil Simms. Phil has been awesome to me, personally. And I don't know how much bosses care about it, but boy, that's got to be tough for morale because he has some other really good color analysts that he just jumped over. And, like, I'm sure he didn't do an audition. Like, look, for Tony, I think it's brilliant. If you're going to keep playing, keep playing. But if you're going to stop playing, only do it if it's the big chair. He couldn't get the big chair at ESPN. He couldn't get the big chair at Fox and CBS thought, you know what, we're done chasing Peyton for now. Let's get Tony Romo. And I think it makes sense because he can give them kind of more updated verbiage, updated analysis of the game. What's he going through? Like, look, I was very fortunate to learn from Dan Steer when I first got there. Dan's now at NBC Sports Network. And everybody swears by Dan because Dan pulls no punches. And I remember my first game I did a doubleheader, me and Dave Revson. We were in Charlotte, North Carolina. And we just thought we killed it. We were like, man, we were so good. And I had done two or three games for ESPN Regional and Pete Durzis right out of college before I went to play in Russia. But, I mean, I had no idea what I was doing. And, I mean, he read me the riot act. Like, you talk too much. You're not focused. And so I remember, like, going in to watch film with him and, like, this is terrible. This is good. But then he went too long. And then Barry Sachs, who was there, who is a prince, and of the people that they've gotten rid of at ESPN, it's a crime that Barry Sachs isn't working for a major network. And Barry used to get on me. He's like, hey, stop being an and guy. Make your point and shut the fuck up, right? He's like, you just keep saying and you're trying to prove how smart you are. And it was great. Sometimes I'm still an and guy, but it's great advice. So Between those two guys, like, I had guys that were really good. And when you're a former athlete, that's how you're used to being talked to. You're used to being told, this is not good. Fix this. This is good. Do more of this. So if I was him, I would do as much as possible in the preseason. Like, hey, I want to do as many preseason games for local networks as you can get me out to do, because reps. And then I would personally, in that building, I would probably sit down with Steve Karasek. I would have a color analyst, doesn't have to be football, that I trust, and have them watch the tape and send me back things. I know there are people who do it as broadcast specialists, you know. There's some people that used to work at ESPN who do it. I think they're fine. I think they're good. There's nothing wrong with them. I think it's better to steal from Bill Pito. You don't know what it's like to you had somebody in your ear, right? Get somebody who has sat there and done the job. But my biggest advice is this. Obviously, you got to watch a bunch of tape so you know what you're talking about. So you're not really guessing. Like, if you've played and you see the game and you're a quarterback, or you're a point guard, you know what's coming before it's coming. And that shit sounds awesome. He's working with Nance, who's going to make him look good. And you have to learn how to use talkback with your producer. You have to learn how to set up the videos, how to tell it straight so you can get in and you can get out and you can make it look pretty. And, like, they have the best shit ever. Like, you walk into a CBS booth and you're like, wow, it does that? Like, yeah, man, it's amazing technology. You know, I think people are wondering whether or not he'll say anything. Like, he doesn't have to. Like, he's going to be there to provide analysis, fresh analysis. And if he can show once or twice a game, it was a big thing that Dan Steer would tell us. Why did it happen? Your job is not to tell me what happened. I can see what happened. Tell me why it happened. If you can tell me why it happened a couple times a half and then show me something that everybody else misses, then you'll be successful. You don't have to prove how much you know the entire game. Just react to Nance, know the players, know the stories, know the assistant coaches, know some reference points, work so you have video that you can bring up. If you can once or twice a half teach me why something happened that I didn't organically see, I think you'll win in the first year.
So I'm going to wrap up with you on a couple quick hits in a second. You know, you mentioned how excited you were about the Fox opportunity, even though it meant leaving CBS, but you also went during that time through the Oklahoma State process. How mentally and personally taxing was that on you, and how do you feel about the way the whole process ended?
It was unbelievably taxing, and there's a bunch of reasons why. Like, I wasn't expecting it. Like, when Travis Ford was fired last year, I knew it was happening in January. It just had to happen. He needed a new place. They needed a new coach. It was over. This one caught everybody by surprise because when Brad Underwood got there, he said, hey, I'm from McPherson, Kansas. This is one of my three dream jobs. I'm staying. And we had kept in touch, and he had turned around a lot of the momentum of the program. And so then when he left, one, just surprise, I think, was emotionally. And then it just made sense to everybody that I felt like I came in second last time. Now you need to show it. You know, you have a guy who said he was loyal but wasn't. Now it's a great time to reunite, to continue to build the bond with fan base and basketball program. So I was fielding calls from former players, from donors, from fans, and as well as other coaches who were like, how can I help? I didn't want to be the guy that would overwhelm the athletic director.
Right.
And have too many people call. He knew who I was. He knew what I was about. He knew I wanted the job. And yet I was, you know, trying to text all these people. And I was also trying to align out, you know, I had a staff in mind. And I wanted to hit the ground running. Like, to me, most people just, I want the job, right? I didn't want the job. Like, I want to kill at that job. And so, you know, my brother was going to be on my staff. And so we're going over players that he's recruiting at Oregon State, guys he knows are going to be available. I'm talking to other people about being on my staff and who they should focus on and the events that are coming up and how quickly I can get approved by the NCAA so I can hit the road. And I wanted to get there, have an interview and say, look, we're going to hit the ground running. Okay. This is not just hire me, win the press conference, Doug's back, everything's great. It's Doug's back. Now we're going to hit the road. We're going to get some players and we're going to get this thing right. Because that's how I believe you do the job. And then my wife was like, look, I can't do this again. She's from 35 minutes from there. We met at school, and that place is very special to us. And last year, I thought I had a really good shot, and then I didn't. And she was just the first 3 or 4 days, she was like, look, I can't look at real estate. I can't think of housing. Like, she mentally was in California already, selling our house in Connecticut. Our kids are in school. My little guy's got baseball tryouts. My daughters are doing their thing, you know, whatever. Like, I can't emotionally invest. And then it suddenly got very real to her. And it became, not everybody, but almost everybody, like, this is a formality. It's going to happen. To go from 0 to 100 to fielding all these calls and texts and tweets and Facebooks, and she's got like 50 family members that live close. Like, are you guys moving here? What's going to happen? You can build a house. What are you going to do? And she's just like trying to manage that. Then to the, you know, I was literally landed from Oklahoma, driving from the airport to my radio show, and I got a call, and they're like, hey, you ain't getting it. And then they hired somebody completely unexpected. Like, the air didn't slowly come out of the balloon. Like, somebody popped it, and, you know, I was in a million different pieces on the sidewalk. So it was a lot. Like, one of the best things about it was the Fox guys were incredible. Not everybody at CBS was incredible the year before. Mm-hmm. When I talked to Oklahoma State and I talked to a couple other people about their jobs, but I want to make sure that they knew before it became public, like, hey, listen, this is a conversation. I have no idea where it's going to go. Not everybody at CBS was, they're like, hey, you work at CBS. Why would you consider another job? At Fox, they were like, dude, you have to go after this job. You have to, if you get it, fine. You always have a home here. And I hadn't even worked for them yet. They were announcing on Wednesday, and like on Tuesday, Oklahoma State called me on the way to my radio show, in which I was flying out to LA after the show. Like, hey, can you come and meet with us on Thursday? I'm like, oh shit. You know, like, is Fox going to want to fire me? Like, Jamie's going to have my ass. Jamie's a former basketball player. And he was like, dude, you got to go get that job. And Jamie Horowitz claims he wanted to be my head recruiter. I have a feeling though that he would have been buying kids, which would have gotten us an NCAA trial. But no, I mean, all seriousness, like, the emotion of, like, I didn't expect it. I'm also not working the NCAA tournament, which was really hard. I left what I thought was a utopia at ESPN. I was very happy there for Selection Sunday in the Final Four. And I knew it was happening long before the world knew it was happening, that I wasn't going to be working it. And I knew I was going to Fox and all that other stuff, but it still sucked to watch it, you know, to like, and people texting you, where are you? Why aren't you? You know, it's like,
yep.
I don't want to update everybody in my life and what's happening. So all of that emotion after one, like, it was a crazy, crazy couple of weeks. And then, you know, you fast forward to the Final Four, and the best thing I did was I just told my wife, like, I'm taking my son and we're just going to go have fun.
All right. I want to wrap with you on this. It's called Quick Hits. Just the first thought that pops into your head to four questions. Okay.
Is this one word?
Yeah. No. First
Jonathan
sentence.
Jonathan Coachman somehow has decided that he is, he owns the rights to one word, even though, like, we all stole things from Pardon the Interruption.
You know, I've consulted with George Sedano. I'm in the clear on this one. I won't earn wrath of Coachman.
I'm glad. As long as George is good with it, I'm good with it.
All right. So if you're a betting man, is Doug Gottlieb coaching or working in sports media in 5 years?
Wow. 5 years?
Yep.
Yes.
Which one? Come on. This is no fence sitting.
To this point, no ADs have the nuts. So I'll say sports media.
The one sports radio host currently doing it better than anyone else is?
Colin.
ESPN's decision to break up Mike and Mike is blank.
Mistake.
And the person who's taught you most about sports broadcasting?
See, I stole them from everybody.
We all have that one influence, though.
I mean, I'd probably say Colin. Dude, I like Lee Hamilton growing up. Like, Lee Hacksaw Hamilton. His 15 minutes, my dad would not get out of his car until the best 15 minutes in radio were done every day. And I don't even know how accurate Lee was, but my dad swore by that. But Colin told me something once. This is a good ending story. We had just both been hired there. It's like a spring Saturday. We didn't have kids at the time. He had just his daughter, Olivia. And this is with his first wife, Kim. And he's like, let's go do something. I was like, what do you want to do? And Andrew's like, let's go bowling. I'm like, are you kidding? We're going to go bowling. All right, we'll go bowling. Right? So we go bowling, and we're having a beer. We're having fun. We're laughing our ass off, telling stories. And Colin said, hey, man, look around. I'm like, what am I looking at? And, you know, there's people that are like women with 1980s hair and guys with tattoos and no sleeves. It looks everything like you think Bristol, Connecticut looks like on a spring Saturday evening, people bowling. And he's like, look around. I look around. He goes, there's your audience. I go, what do you mean? He goes, how well-read are you? I go, I'm pretty well-read. Like, you know, I love to read a book. He's like, your audience doesn't. You know, your audience doesn't care about art. Your audience doesn't care about theater. You know, your audience bowls on a Saturday night. Your audience watches football on Sunday. Sports radio, remember who your audience is. And I thought it was incredible advice.
Well, man, I'm looking forward to watching you on FS1 and listening to you on Fox Sports Radio. Congrats. It's a heck of an opportunity for you. You get to reunite with some familiar faces, good friends in the business, and go make the most of it.
I appreciate it. And you know radio, and I would challenge you to find a better national lineup than Clay Travis, Dan Patrick, Colin Cowherd to me. And I think no different than sports and anything else. You're only as good as the people who surround you. And those guys are awesome. And so I'm seriously stoked about being a part of it.
All right, man. I appreciate the time.
All right, brother. See you.
This is the Barrett Sports Media Podcast.
That was a fun trip down memory lane with Doug Gottlieb. You know, a number of things stood out to me from that conversation. First, know your audience. The story he shared about his experience with Colin Cowherd at the bowling alley was fantastic. And it's something every host should have a mental image of when talking on the radio. Secondly, if you don't know something, you shouldn't be spitting it to someone else. Always be prepared when you get behind the microphone or in front of a camera. I thought that was great advice. And finally, in the case of what Tony Romo is going to face, and for anyone who gets the opportunity to work on television, whether it be as an analyst or as an announcer, don't tell the viewer what happened. Explain why it happened. If you can teach the audience something 1 to 2 times per half, you'll be very successful in this business. Those are excellent words of wisdom for those of you who are in the industry right now and looking to find your groove in connecting with an audience. That's going to bring this week's episode to a close. Before I sign off, I'd like to remind you that it helps me out a great deal if you take a moment to leave a review for the podcast on iTunes and spread the word to others. If you're interested in talking business, you can find my contact information on the website, sportsradiopd.com. That's also how you can reach me if you have a news tip, press release, or industry-related question to pass along. In the words of Kid Rock, if it sounds good, you'll hear it. If it looks good, you'll see it. If it's marketed right, you'll buy it. But if it's real, you'll feel it. So be authentic in everything you do. Until next time, I'm Jason Barrett. Thanks for stopping by.
I'd say that was a pretty successful broadcast.
Thank you for listening to the Barrett Sports Media Podcast. To stay updated on the latest sports media news, follow Jason on Twitter at SportsRadioPD and visit our website, sportsradiopd.com.